From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, for movie theater owners and the people who go to the multiplex, is this the best of times or the worst of times, or maybe both? And the reduced Shakespeare Company asks, if there was a Da Vinci Code style of thriller about the Bard, what would be the secret treasure?
It would be an original manuscript of a play. And he's a young genius writer, but he doesn't have the craft enough to know that he should put all these different characters into 37 different plays.
And Yo-Yo Ma is traveling the globe with an ambitious project about Bach. All that coming up on The Frame.
Podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Dogman from the director of Gomorrah is a crime thriller that tells a story of vengeance where only the strong survive. Best Actor winner at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. Opens April 12th in New York and LA.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. I'm just back from Las Vegas, where I watched way too many trailers of what Hollywood will soon be sending your way. I was at CinemaCon, the annual gathering of movie theater owners. Over the last few days, they gathered in the massive auditorium where Celine Dion usually performs. Studios showed theater owners scores of clips and trotted out stars like Charlize Theron, Dwayne Johnson, and Chadwick Boseman. But right before CinemaCon started, Disney closed its deal to acquire 20th Century Fox. So what could that merger mean to films headed to the multiplex? I brought up that and other issues, like movie ratings, with John Fithian, who's the head of the National Association of Theater Owners. And I started by asking him about the combined Disney and Fox release schedule, which is so crowded with movie titles, it looks like a New York subway map.
That slide with all the Disney and Fox movies layered on top of each other was really impressive in terms of how many movies they're going to have spread across the whole year. And we've had discussions with them, and Disney didn't pay all that money to Fox not to keep making those Fox movies and putting them out there. So there's going to be a lot of movies coming from that company. There are 52 weeks in the year, and there is the ability to counter program on any one weekend. They're not going to put two of their big movies in one weekend. They're going to put one of their big movies in one weekend. And the other distributors will look at what that genre is, what kind of demographic it appeals to, and they'll counter program against it.
Helen Mirren famously said in the Coliseum in front of exhibitors, "I love Netflix, but Netflix. I like going to the movies in a cinema." The theater owners clearly have an issue with the Netflix window or lack of a window. Is there a middle ground? Is it just an either-or question? We're not going to book Netflix movies because they don't respect a three-month window? Is there any alternate version of a release where Netflix is able to exhibit its films with your member companies?
Netflix is not really relevant to the theatrical business right now. I mean, we had an $11.9 billion year last year with almost no support from Netflix whatsoever. So our business is growing and we're strong in theatrical at the same time that streaming and subscription services are growing. And indeed, our research, we commissioned two annual research so far from Ernst & Young that shows that people who go to movies a lot are the same people that watch movies and other content on streaming. So the two platforms are complementary. They're not cannibalistic. Movie lovers are movie lovers and they want to watch them everywhere. The last part of the long answer to your question is, you know, is there some middle ground there between Netflix and theater owners? And I wouldn't say it's a quote unquote middle ground. There's a misperception often reported that there's a fixed 90-day window in the domestic marketplace. That's really an average. And there are ranges of windows from like 70 days to 120 in movies being released theatrically today, based on the type of movie, how long it's going to play, how big the budget was. Does it need a while to platform and breathe, or is it a movie that's going to burn off quickly? And so there's already flexibility built into the market on the length of the theatrical run being related to the movie. Would that kind of existing flexibility range work for Netflix or not? I don't know. That's kind of up to them, right? But I do know they have lots of filmmakers that would really like a big, long theatrical run with their movies and believe in them. And like I said, the door's open. If Netflix wants to come play, we'd love to have their movies.
Joan Graves, who has headed the MPAA's ratings board for a very long time, is retiring, and there was a tribute to her. And it made me think about where the ratings are now and where they could go. And as a parent, I have issues with the ratings in terms of the way they penalize language and sex and nudity, but not so much violence.
you might be surprised to find that over 70% of America's parents think that one use of the F word should automatically qualify for an R rating. Over 70% of America's parents think we're a little too loose on language, not too restrictive. America's parents are very satisfied with how we rate violence, for example. I'm not saying they're satisfied that there's violence in movies, but they're satisfied with how we rate the movies for violence, even though some folks on the East and West Coast think maybe we should be more restrictive on violence and less restrictive on language or sex or whatever. What we have to do is take most of America's parents' views into mind when we set those ratings. Otherwise, we'd have a different rating for every state in the country, and that would be an impossible system.
I want to push back a little bit on that, because there also have been studies that have shown that the amount of violence in a PG-13 movie today is greater than was in an R-rated movie just a decade ago.
So I think you just confirmed instead of contradicted my point, John, in that this is a dynamic system that is not the same year to year, decade to decade. And the driving principle is, and literally this is the question that we ask, what would most America's parents think is an appropriate rating for this film with this content? And America's parents' views on violence have changed over the last 10 or 20 years. We can't let our own personal values of either the quality of the movie or its contents influence the system. It's got to be driven by what parents think. And what parents think evolves over time.
There has been a lot of talk about security and cybersecurity and piracy here. I want to ask you about actual physical security. We live in dangerous times in this country with mass shootings. Do your members and do you worry about the safety of going to the theater?
So security and safety is a big priority for us. And at the Trade Association, we have lots of tools, lots of training programs, lots of opportunities for our members to learn about security. And it's not just about, you know, the remote possibility of a mass shooter. It's security about natural disasters. And we have training programs on hurricanes and what happens to our theaters in places like the Caribbean and the East Coast when they're confronting bad weather. It's about cybersecurity and making sure we're protecting our customers' data. So there are a range of security issues that we address, and we spend a lot of time on. We take it very seriously.
John, thanks for your time. Great to see you.
Good to see you too. Thanks for coming to Vegas. We're glad you're at our convention.
Coming up, the Reduce Shakespeare Company says it has found the Bard's long-lost first play, but don't believe them. The Reduce Shakespeare Company put itself on the map with the complete works of William Shakespeare, Abridged, a fast-paced slapstick comedy condensing all of Shakespeare's 37 plays into just 90 minutes. In their latest creation, William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, writers and actors Austin Titchener and Reed Martin imagine if the Bard's first work was actually drafted before he had enough sense to give Lady Macbeth and Hamlet their own stories. Titchener and Martin are joined on stage by Teddy Spencer. Titchener and Martin are actually college classmates of mine. We all studied theater together at UC Berkeley I'm not going to say how many years ago. When we reconnected, I asked them how they came up with the idea for the new show more than 400 years after Shakespeare's time.
We were given a private tour of the vaults at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., and I produce a weekly Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast, and so I had my microphone with me, and we recorded the interview down in the vault, and my wife asked the question, actually, and she said, "What if they were making a Da Vinci Code kind of movie, but about Shakespeare, what would the treasure be?" And the answer was immediate. It was like, oh, well, it would be an original manuscript of a play in Shakespeare's hand. Such a thing does not exist. And it seems unlikely, though not impossible, that we will ever find one. But we were performing at the Kennedy Center that night, and Reed and I just said, oh, well, we should write it then. We should write a long-lost Shakespeare play. Oh, and we should make it his first play. And he's a young genius writer, but he doesn't have the craft enough to know that he should put all these different characters into 37 different plays, not just one play, and we'll make it 100 hours long. And
so we have to abridge it.
So we have to reduce it. And so we said, well, you know, since it doesn't exist, let's just create it.
I've actually seen you guys do the show at Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival a couple of years ago. And I'm wondering, when you were doing any of your plays that involve Shakespeare and you're performing, say, in Edinburgh versus, say, Santa Monica, are there certain things that audiences get, depending on how well versed they are with Shakespeare, that maybe don't travel as well? Do you notice regional reactions based on the material?
What's interesting is that audiences around the world vary to the same degree. You know, there are people in the audience who really love Shakespeare and really get all the references. There are others who have been brought kicking and screaming to the performance by a lover or a parent or somebody, and they've been taught Shakespeare and they think they're going to hate it and they come out loving it. I mean, what's lovely about Shakespeare is that we, internationally, we all seem to have the same reactions to him.
Yeah, I mean, we hope it plays at the level of sort of the very best classic Looney Tunes, where something like What's Opera, Doc?, where it's just Bugs Bunny and it's funny and it's silly. And if you know nothing about Wagner, it's funny anyway. And then you go back as an adult and watch it. And if you know something about opera, well, there's all kinds of levels that you didn't know you were missing as a kid. And so at our best, we hope it plays like that.
If you know Shakespeare's plays, you know there's a lot of murder, suicide, betrayal, war, and that's just the comedies.
Hello.
But when you start thinking about Shakespeare, there's not always something that is inherently funny about Shakespeare compared to, say, Ibsen or Chekhov. So why is Shakespeare such good material for comedy?
Well, first, I'm going to take issue with the humor of Ibsen and Chekhov. But secondly, yeah, you're exactly right. And we find it's a lot easier to make fun of the tragedies than it is of the comedies. For one, the comedies, a lot of them haven't aged very well. It's like making a joke on a joke.
Right.
But as kind of the more seriously something is taken, the easier it is to sort of kick the stool out from under it.
Well, and sometimes there is something inherently funny about people speaking in verse. I mean, it's a style a little bit like a musical where people suddenly break into song. You know, there's fun to be had with the performance style. What's fun about Shakespeare's long-lost play is that for us it was both a fun sort of academic exercise. What would it be like if the various characters from all of Shakespeare's different plays were mashed together in a sort of a single Shakespearean universe? But it also became hysterical to put Lady Macbeth suddenly helping Hamlet make up his mind. And suddenly, that's a very short play.
Yeah, or Dromio and Juliet, sisters from a Scottish play, or also, you know, King Lear's daughters.
Other actors have fallen in love with your plays. Even one of our producers, Julia Paskin, once performed in an all-female production of the complete works Abridged. I hope they paid their royalty. But here's what she had
to say. I wanted to talk to her about that.
But here's what she had to say about performing in this show.
It was many years ago, and I still remember it quite vividly, mainly because I have never sweat so much on stage. You have to change so many characters and costumes, and at the end of it, you're so tired, but you're kind of in this blissful exhaustion. Like, if there was a theater version of Iron Man, I feel like it would be the material that Reduced Shakespeare Company produces, because it's just so dense that you just have to bring a different level of energy to really play it.
I want to ask you about that, the different level of energy to play it, because at the end of one of your shows, assuming the air conditioning, even if it's working, you guys are drenched. So how much of the performance is a physical challenge as opposed to kind of a verbal one?
Well, it's more of a physical challenge than it used to be.
Yeah.
It's fun. People come up to us after the show and says, it looks like you're having so much fun. And we are. And I think that energy drives us, because like in real life, we do things on stage that we don't sort of, you know, the energy we have to put out is crazy. But it's fun. You just get carried along. I mean, you got a house full of people, you know, 300, 500, 1,200 people just laughing hysterically. They sort of energize you. But it's exhausting.
Well, and I love her quote, blissful exhaustion. We need to put that on the poster.
Yeah, or just exhausting.
Or just exhaustion. No, but it's absolutely true. You know, it does require a different level of energy. And sometimes I'll go to see, quote unquote, regular theater, and I wish they had the same energy that we sort of bring, because, you know, you've got people coming out to the theater, they've got babysitters, they paid for parking, whatever, they left their house. You need to give them something. And what I love is, you know, I get on stage and I can still do things on stage that when I'm off stage, I can't do.
Well, Austin, you say frequently, you're amazed, sort of expanding on what you just said. People made these arrangements months ago.
Yeah.
Babysitters, booking a dinner, coming to the show, forking out this money. money to see us, right? I think I owe them something.
Well, absolutely. And she also said dense. And I went, yeah, in every sense, our material is pretty dense.
We certainly are.
We're talking with Reed Martin and Austin Titchener about the Reduced Shakespeare Company. I don't want to betray any secrets, but I do want to ask about a couple of things from your past and about how that influenced what you do today. Reed, at one point, if I remember correctly, you were a professional umpire student. Is that right?
I was a professional umpire, yes.
So how does baseball umpiring lead to what you're doing today?
Well, it almost directly. In 1980, I took a quarter off and went to the Bill Kinnaman School of Professional Baseball Umpiring in St. Petersburg, Florida. And then I finished near the top of my class. We went to spring training in Bradenton, Florida. This was 1980. The We Are Family Pittsburgh Pirates were world champions in 79. So we're at spring training with the Pirates. And then I got a job in the Pioneer League, which is the lowest level of professional minor league baseball. Shortly after that, I took a theater class and said, wait a minute, people aren't cursing at me and kicking dirt on my shoes, or just not very frequently. I'm going into theater. So, yes, I think the abuse of professional baseball umpiring encouraged me to move into the theater.
I want to ask you how competitive bird whistling in high school set you up for what you're doing today.
It never really went anywhere. My competitive bird whistling, I'm not even sure I can still do the Xanadura macrura carolinensis or the common mourning dove. But I can do this. I can do... And I've used that in actual Reduced Shakespeare Company performances. So I guess anything that's a stupid human trick that you can do, we put into our shows.
People see our shows and they say, oh, you do so many wonderful tricks. You're such a new vaudevillian. I can't wait to see what you do next. And we go, no, you've pretty much seen everything we got.
But I do understand you brought a ukulele. I don't think of a lot of ukulele in Shakespeare's time. Maybe I'm not getting the history right. But tell me how you incorporate music into your show.
I think of the ukulele as a kind of a modern lute. And we discovered in the writing of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, that in his first play, he made the potentially fatal mistake of making his character of Richard III a really nice guy, which he might have been. He was probably less evil than Shakespeare portrayed him eventually. But in his first play, he made him a really nice guy, pining for Beatrice, who we know from his play Much Ado About Nothing. And he sees her, and he tries to woo her, and he's failing, and he says, no, if I cannot prove a lover, I am determined to prove a vaudevillian. Sigh no more, lady, sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. One foot in sea and one on shore, to one thing constant never. So sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds of woe into, hey, I was upset when Beatrice said she didn't love me, but I slept like a baby. I puked and cried and wet the bed. So sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds of woe into, hey, my shrink said I was crazy. I said, I want a second opinion. He said, okay, you're a hunchback too. Converting all your sounds of woe into, hey, they laughed when I said I wanted to be a comedian. Well, they're not laughing now. Converting all your sounds of woe into, hey, nonny, nonny. Was ever woman in this humor wooed? Was ever woman in this humor won?
No.
Exactly.
And scene.
Reed Martin and Austin Titchener are in the Reduced Shakespeare Company. They'll be performing William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, on April 5th and 6th at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. Austin and Reed, great to have you on the show.
It's great to chat with you again.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up on The Frame, Yo-Yo Ma's ambitious Bach project makes a stop in Mexico City.
KPCC podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Presenting Dogman, a sly crime thriller from the award-winning director of Gomorra. Winner of the Best Actor Award at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival and the European Film Awards. Dogman tells a story of vengeance where only the strong will survive. Official selection of the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals and the winner of 9 Italian Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, and Actor. Opens Friday, April 12th in New York and Los Angeles.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. the beloved cellist Yo-Yo Ma has embarked on a hugely ambitious endeavor. In the multi-layered Bach project, he's performing the composer's 6 cello suites in one sitting in 36 cities across 6 continents. The cellist also participates in cultural activities with local communities in each of those locales. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos was at Yo-Yo Ma's recent stop in Mexico City and has this report.
It's a cool and breezy Tuesday evening at the Plaza de la República, a large public square near downtown Mexico City. More than 20,000 people came here tonight to listen to Yo-Yo Ma's performance of Bach's 6 cello suites. Right after he finished playing the 4th suite, Ma stood up from his chair and addressed the massive, captivated audience in Spanish. He said, "I would like to dedicate the next piece to all the brave people, the disappeared, and those who have suffered from violence." Within a few seconds after speaking those brief yet powerful words, hundreds of people spontaneously started counting from 1 to 43 in reference to the 43 college students who were abducted in the state of Guerrero in September of 2014, allegedly by police officers collaborating with criminal gangs. Their bodies have never been found. Then, Yo-Yo Ma began playing Bach's Cello Suite No. 5. The next day, Yo-Yo Ma was at an event called Community Culture of Peace Interaction, part of the Bach Project's Days of Action. The event was held at La Nana Cultural Center in a working-class neighborhood near the city's historic district. At this event, attended by more than 100 people, the participants included teachers, dancers, visual artists, musicians, and many people from the local community. The first activity was a free-form dance exercise performed to Danzón No. 2 by Mexico's renowned classical composer Arturo Márquez. Next, the group was led by musician Enrique Jiménez in a series of percussive exercises with their hands and feet. Jiménez attended Yo-Yo Ma's concert and was touched by the musician's gesture when he dedicated Bach's 5th suite to the disappeared. He said it was a big lesson to musicians in Mexico.
Sometimes we're on our ivory tower thinking we're not affected by what happens around us. And just making music is enough. And it's good to make music. But when you give meaning to the music you play, that's when it reaches other dimensions. What Yo-Yo Ma did last night was very symbolic and meaningful.
Jiménez divided the group into 4 sections of about 25 people each and got them to improvise a song with their voices layered. The group was then asked to keep silent for 3 minutes to reflect on the theme of peace as they listened to music composed by Mari Carmen Graue. Graue is a local cellist and teacher who was invited to write the music. She says it was especially meaningful to see an artist of such stature participate in a community event.
Yo-Yo Ma's humility and simplicity, integrating himself to the community and showing his human quality, has been very special for me to see up close.
After a short video presentation focused on 2 artists working at the cultural center, Yo-Yo Ma sat down, he tuned his cello, and began to play Bach Suite No. 1. As the audience formed a circle around them, a man in a wheelchair and a woman in a beige dress danced freely as Yo-Yo Ma played on. The event closed with a performance by the Cultural Center's 13-piece house band called Ella Disonante. Yo-Yo Ma grabbed his cello and joined the band as they played a 15-minute medley that included the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends.
So we are doing things together We are all equal in this house, and we get to a moment of common spirituality that gives us the energy,
la energía,
and the hope,
y la esperanza,
and the determination,
y la determinación,
when we get out of this house to practice the very values that we have found under this roof.
Mari Carmen Legazpi, director of CONARTE, the nonprofit that oversees La Nana Cultural Center, says Yo-Yo Ma has a similar vision of culture and community as her organization. Legazpi says the cultural center, located in a rough neighborhood in Mexico City, has a special function, to care for the people who live in this barrio.
I think that's why Yo-Yo Ma was interested in it, because the theme of peace and community is a top priority for him. So his visits to a space like this, in a complicated barrio where people are vulnerable in violent situations, drug addiction and poverty, for him, it's important that this is the heart of this barrio, where there are opportunities to make art for everyone.
That's the essence of the BAC Project's Days of Action, to help people have a better quality of life, to help them be creative and contribute positively to society. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos in Mexico City.
Yo-Yo Ma's BAC Project is not scheduled for a stop in Southern California. You can check his website for the itinerary. And that is it for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Andrea Gutierrez. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. And thanks to Stephen Cuevas for filling in. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We're back here on Monday.